Good morning, everyone, and welcome. Welcome to everyone, whether you're here in the pews or whether you're joining us via technology. This morning is a lovely, easy service for me because this is a service where people bring along a reading that they feel might be helpful and they want to share with others. So we begin with our opening words. Let us rejoice in the light of this morning, in the glory and warmth of summer sun, in the earth as it blossoms and bursts into new life. Let us rejoice in the grasses and the trees, the warmth, the flowers, and the many hidden treasures of earth. Let us rejoice together this day. Our chalice lighting. May this light symbolize the light that shines within. Let it shine today to each one of us, in what we feel, in everything we do. Let your light shine. So we're going to have our first hymn now. And this morning, all the hymns we're going to sing were chosen by Bill Darlison. So Bill is probably listening in Yorkshire and going to sing. The neighbours will be complaining. Our first hymn is hymn number 271, Come Down, O Love Divine. Hymn number 271. Let us pray. Eternal God, Spirit of life, we are grateful for the companionship of hearts and minds seeking to speak the truth in love. We are grateful for our heritage, for the women and men before us, whose prophetic words and deeds make possible our dreams and our insight. We are grateful for the gift of life itself, mindful that to respect life means both to celebrate what it is and to insist on what it can become. May we always rejoice in life and work to cultivate a sense of giftedness, but may we also heed the call to transformation and to growth. May we find in ourselves strength to face our adversities, the integrity to name them, and the vision to overcome them. May we honor in pride the heroes and heroines of our past, but may we keep company with the fallen, the broken, and the oppressed. For in the noontime heat and the star-studded shimmering of the night's rich blackness, we remember that we are one human family and that we are connected in love to each other and to God. Amen. Now can we say the words that attempt to articulate the aspirations of our community? And they're in the back of the hymn book, printed on the back page. Love is the doctrine of this church. The quest of truth is its sacrament, and service is its prayer. To dwell together in peace, to seek knowledge in freedom, to serve mankind in fellowship, to the end that all souls shall grow in harmony with the divine. This do we covenant with each other and with God. Now we're going to have a children's story, and we have some young people here. They're not children anymore. So can you come to the front to help me tell the story to the adults, lads? Hello, it's lovely to see you here. And you're not children, but the adults like to pretend that they are children, you see. You get to a certain age and you get like that. This is a once upon a time story. Once upon a time, long ago, in a foreign country, there was a man and he was going to visit his friend who lived in a town quite a distance away. And it was a town this man didn't know. But he was looking for his friend, and his friend was pretty distinctive, and he thought, sure, when I get to the town, I'll find out where he lives. So when he got to the town, he was very tired. The journey had been far more difficult than he thought, and he was tired. And he got to the town, and it was much bigger than he thought it would be. And he thought, how on earth am I going to find my friend in this big space? I wonder, would anyone know where he lives? And he thought, sure, it's going to be really difficult. And just after that, when he looked around, he saw a man begging. And he was very kind. He was taking out a penny to give to the man. And he noticed the man had a sign underneath him, beside him. And the sign said, I tell the truth for one penny. Right? And he thought, that's interesting. I wonder what this means. And as he was giving him the coin, he said, well, I'll test out his theory. I'll ask him where my friend lives. Anyway, he said, okay, if you can tell the truth for one penny, here's the penny. I'm looking for my friend, Hu Shui. Where does he live? And the man just thought for a moment and he says, right, you take three turns to the left, one to the right, and when you get on that roadway, go down an alleyway. It's very, very crowded. But halfway down, there's an alleyway. And off the alleyway, there are houses. And all the houses have stone stairs leading up to them. But there's one that has wooden stairs. If you go to the one with the wooden stairs, your friend, Hu Shui, will be there. And the guy thought, do you know what? I'll try it. I'm tired. I'll just try it. So he followed the directions, went up the wooden stairs, exactly as the man had said, knocked on the first door, and his friend Hu Shui opened the door. Well, he was very surprised at that, but very happy that he'd found his friend. The friend brought him in and gave him some refreshment. And the two men were talking about it. And Hu Shui said, well, I don't know how he could possibly have known that, because I only moved in here today. He says, this is my very first day in this house. I don't know how he would know where I lived, and I don't know the guy. So obviously, Hu Shui was very taken with this and thinking about it. And the next day, Hu Shui decided, I'll test the guy and see, can he tell me something? And he went down and he thought, now this is Hu Shui going down. He said, I'm really going to test the guy. And he went up to him and he said, I see you tell the truth for one penny. He says, can you tell me where Hu Shui is? He thought, now he's really, really giving him a test, asking him where he was himself. And the man said, you see the tailor shop across the road? Go in there and ask them to try on a suit. And when you have the suit on, ask them to see it in the mirror. And when you look in the mirror, that's where Hu Shui is. So Hu Shui is absolutely gobsmacked at this. How did this man know this? And he says, tell me, you're amazing. I'm really, really amazed at how you can know these things, because I know that you don't know me. And the man said, it's funny, really. He says, I tell the truth for one penny. That's all I charge. And he says, the silly questions people ask me are absolutely unbelievable. He said, I could have told you the truth of the universe and all the things about life and death and God, and you ask me where you are. People are a bit like that. Okay, so thank you very much, Bella, Dina, and Michael. We're going to have our second hymn, and it's hymn number 319, Ye Earthborn Children of a Star. And for the musical among you, just to say, Josh says it's not the tune that's in the book. Mm-hmm. This is our favourite reading service, and our first reader this morning is Moira. People choose the readings themselves. I've no idea what they're going to read, but very often a theme develops. Probably won't happen today now that I've said that, but let's see.
Good morning. My reading this morning is from a book of poetry by Mari Cadden. It's called Gynecologist in the Jacuzzi. She was born in England and moved to Spiddle with her husband and lived there for 40 years till she died too young in 2017. She was a friend of my brother and sister-in-law. I never met her. When I read her poems, I feel she knew me. A bit of peace. I prowl the house looking for solitude. In the kitchen, the dishwasher frets, voices hassle from the playroom, TV agitates in the lounge. I retreat to a bath by candlelight, a glass of port, a book, an early night. On such an evening in a cottage kitchen 90 years ago, my father's mother, so he said, could elude the 12 of them without stirring from the hearth. Amidst the jangled clatter of voices, hard-edged surfaces, grandmother would find asylum. Buttermilk cans lifted upwards the long skirt of her apron, she'd lay it over her head, then sit, hooded and still in her one choice sanctuary. Untouchable, out of bounds, until the little ones yawned for bed. Grandmother, I'm raising my glass to you.
Janet is our second reader.
Good morning, everybody. I'm not a member of the Refugee Committee, but a few weeks ago I was invited down to touch base with our refugee family in Mullingar. And as I say, I'm not a member, so I considered it a huge compliment to be able to go and to spend an afternoon with them. And we had a lovely lunch. At the same time, I was trying to find something decent to read, and I came across in this book titled Finding Hope by Sister Stan, I came across the writings of a lady known as Teresa Bukowska. She is a migrant woman. She is a social anthropologist, migrant rights activist, and a writer. And she also works as the integration manager at the Immigrant Council of Ireland. She's a writer, and her second language to write in is English. Her main genre of writing is creative non-fiction. And Teresa's main writing themes are the notion of home, identity and belonging, grief, and the communal violence. When I came across this writing, I just thought about the Refugee Committee and all of the fantastic work that they have done. The title of the writing is Hope is to Act. We exist in a state of uncertainty, full of many movable elements that can turn our lives one way or another. To alleviate the feeling of uncertainty, we often resort to hope. Hope is an expectation that the future we wish for will arrive despite any known and unknown obstacles. However, what is the basis for such an expectation? As a person with a rather pragmatic approach to life, basing hope on an abstract expectation that is hung in a vacuum does not project confidence against uncertainty. Despite my pragmatism, however, I am a person full of hope, because without hope, the uncertainty of life would be much too frightening. What is my hope rooted in? The word hope in Polish translates as nadzieja, and it derives from an old Slavic word that means to happen, but also to make or to act. Looking back, I understand now why inertia has been my biggest challenge to sustain hope. I cannot say whether I started losing hope when I was falling into an inertia, or whether inertia entered my life when I started to lose hope. Either way, hope, nadzija, for me, can only exist when the expectation for the future is supported by some forms of making that future. I see hope when I see acts of resilience, even the smallest ones that are no more than just words of objections to injustice. I feel hope when I am standing up for the values and future I want to see for myself and for others. Most of all, experiencing and participating in collective acts of solidarity is the most nourishing source of hope. There is more power, motivation, and energy when we act together towards the future we wish for than when we stand alone. It's easy to fall into an inertia when we are alone, and inertia is the biggest enemy of hope.
Our next reader is Denise.
Good morning. I'm reading this morning from a book called The Sleeper and the Spindle by Neil Gaiman, and it's a modern fairy tale, or a modern take on a fairy tale. It's inspired by the characters of Snow White and Sleeping Beauty, but it takes the story in a different direction. A sleeping sickness has fallen over the kingdom in which the Sleeping Beauty character lives, and it's beginning to spread. And the Queen, the Snow White character, has been notified by her royal court that they fear that it will come over the mountains, and the sleeping sickness will begin to infect their kingdom. So the Queen, despite the fact that she is due to be married in a few days, decides that she and some of her dwarf retainers will go and investigate and see what they can do to resolve the problem. So this is just a very short piece from it. "Asleep," asked the Queen. "Explain yourselves. How so asleep?" The dwarf stood up upon the table so he could look her in the eye. "Asleep," he repeated, "sometimes crumpled on the ground, sometimes standing. They sleep in their smithies, in their awls, on milking stools. The animals sleep in the fields. Birds too slept, and we saw them in trees or dead and broken in the fields where they had fallen from the sky." The Queen wore a wedding gown, whiter than the snow. Around her attendants, maids of honour, dressmakers and milliners clustered and fussed. "And why did you three not fall asleep?" The dwarf shrugged. He had a russet brown beard that always made the Queen think of an angry hedgehog attached to the lower portion of his face. "Dwarfs are magical things, and this sleep is a magical thing too. I felt sleepy, mind." "And then?" She was the Queen. She was questioning him as if they were alone. Her attendants began to remove her gown, taking it away, folding it and wrapping it, so the final laces and ribbons could be attached to it so that it would be perfect. Tomorrow would be the Queen's wedding day. Everything needed to be perfect. "By the time we returned to the Fox's Inn, they were all asleep, every man, Jack and Jill of them. It is expanding, the zone of the spell, a few miles every day. The mountains that separated the two lands were impossibly high, but not wide. The Queen could count the miles. She pushed one pale hand through her raven-black hair, and she looked most serious. What do you think, then?" she asked the dwarf. "If I went there, would I sleep, as they did?" He scratched himself unselfconsciously. "You slept for a year," he said, "and then you woke again, none the worse for it. And if any of the big people can stay awake there, it's you." Outside, the townsfolk were hanging bunting in the streets, decorating their doors and windows with white feathers. Silverware had been polished, and protesting children had been forced into tubs of lukewarm water. The oldest child got the first dunk and the hottest water, and scrubbed with rough flannels until their faces were red and raw. Then they were dunked under the water, and the backs of their ears were washed as well. "I'm afraid," said the Queen, "that there will be no wedding tomorrow." She called for a map of the kingdom, identified the villages closest to the mountains, and sent messages to the inhabitants to evacuate to the coast or risk royal displeasure. She called for her first minister and informed him that he would be responsible for the kingdom in her absence, and that he should do his best neither to lose it nor to break it. She called for her fiancé and told him not to take on so, that they would still be married, even if he was but a prince and she a queen, and she chucked him beneath his pretty chin and kissed him until he smiled. She called for her mail shirt. She called for her sword. She called for provisions and her horse, and then she rode out of the palace towards the east.
Gavin is going to play something on the piano. Our next reader is Peter White.
Good morning. I went looking for something to read, and I was quite charmed to find a poem by Derek Mann called Washing Up. And I find that the poem, in a way, represents for me the way this church treasures ordinary people with a certain sense of humour and without the strict hierarchy. So this, for me, I was delighted to find. It starts off with the Chinese proverb, "The miracle is not to fly in the air or to walk in water, but to stand on the earth." You do gastronomy, I wash up and rinse under a running tap. I like it, on the whole. It gives me time to think about our lives here at the edge, no, at the eye of real existence, wind and sky, working together to define the limits of our own domain. There's so much washing up to do on the degraded planet now, oceans and forests, oily sands, our filthy, lucrative demands on the resources of this place and soon, perhaps, of outer space. Beyond the window, a bright star notes my performance from afar, twinkling to find a widower engaged on a domestic chore. a relic of pre-digital times, fond of anachronistic rhymes. In flight from the new politique of induced squalor and high tech, washed up on a deserted beach, grumpy, contrarian, out of reach. I stand here at the kitchen sink, watching the soap bubbles blink. No, here at the sink I stand with a wet, drying cloth in hand, dreaming not of that caricature, an automatic dishwasher, but of an even simpler life, untouched by electronic stuff. The best of miracles rely on the old known reality. Pines where the wood pigeons live, wild garlic growing in the drive, the nightly fun of wiping dry dishes and bowls and cutlery. Washing up here along this shore, as urban exiles can be sure, of a real world where fauna thrive and precious habitats survive, where swifts back from Rwanda find unchanged the nests they left behind, and hungry gulls remain content with their own fishy nourishment. However much we wish her ill, nature as such is hard to kill. The more insistent our demands, the more severely she responds by turning up the heat again so we too register the pain. Golfers in helicopters fly here, dropping daily from the sky, and surfers who might prefer not to be here but in Hawaii. But these are just technology playing its games with sea and air. Knowing our place, I infer from my perspective as plongeur, in the whole turbulent shebang, the universe and everything is the one miracle that wins out over our rake of sins. It might be going too far to say life is worth living anyway for the naive and unprepared, despite the violence endured, or the despondent migrant crowds out on the road like drifting clouds. What do we know in our resigned enclosure, sheltered from the wind? But don't we cherish all the same our long-sought equilibrium? I stack the plates with diligence, glad to have been of use for once, and step outside to watch the sea washing up in the estuary.
Aidan has a reading for us.
Good morning to you all. I would like to read a piece from this book here. It's called Small Things Like These by Claire Keegan. Claire Keegan is a highly regarded Irish writer who is known for her spare but very elegant prose. She is perhaps best known from an earlier novella called Foster, which provided the source material for the iconic Irish film on Colleen Kuhn, or The Quiet Girl. The reason I have chosen to read this piece is that it describes a point in the story where the lead character, Furlong, makes a commitment, steps up to the plate, does what he perceives to be the right undertaking. I think many of us are often slow, reluctant to commit. I think this is understandable. There may be unknown consequences. So when we see others taking responsibility and doing the decent thing, I think we can be encouraged, perhaps inspired. To introduce the piece, I just read a few lines from the blurb that give us a setting. It is 1985 in an Irish town. During the weeks leading up to Christmas, Bill Furlong, a coal and timber merchant, faces his busiest season. As he goes around the houses making deliveries, he feels the past rising up to meet him and encounters the complicit silences of a small community controlled by the church. In the square, they paused to rest at the lighted manger. She stood in a type of trance, looking in. Furlon looked in too, at Joseph's bright robes, the kneeling virgin, the sheep. Someone since he had last seen it had placed the figures of the wise men and the baby Jesus there, but it was the donkey that held the girl's attention, and she reached out to stroke and push the snow off its ear. "Isn't he lovely?" she said. "We've not far to go now," Furlong assured. "We're almost home." As they carried along and met more people that Furlong did and did not know, he found himself asking, was there any point in being alive without helping one another? Was it possible to carry on through all the years, the decades, through an entire life, without once being brave enough to go against what was out there, and yet call yourself a Christian and face yourself in the mirror? How light and tall he almost felt walking along with this girl at his side, and some fresh, new, unrecognizable joy in his heart. Was it possible that the best of him was shining forth and surfacing? Some part of him, whatever it could be called, was there a name for it, was going wild, he knew. The fact that he would pay for it, but never once in his whole and unremarkable life had he known a happiness akin to this. Not even when his infant girls were first placed in his arms and he had heard their healthy, obstinate cries. He thought of Mrs. Wilson, of her daily kindnesses, and of how she had corrected and encouraged him, of the small things she had said and done, and refused to do and say, and what she must have known, the things which, when added up, amounted to a life. Had it not been for her, his mother might well have wound up in that place. In an earlier time, it would have been his own mother he was saving, if saving was what this could be called. And only God knew what would have happened to him and where he might have ended up. Clare Keegan, Small Things Like These.
Our next reader is Sean.
I haven't spoken yet. Okay, I'm just going to think this is a good height for it. Okay. Hello. I'm going to read some of the introduction to the book Cook As You Are, because it happens to be my favorite cookbook. It's written by Ruby Tando, who's an extremely accomplished food writer and author from the UK. Too often, when we cook, we turn the old cliche inside out. Instead of "you are what you eat," it becomes "you eat what you want to be," "how you think you should be," "what you think you deserve." We cook or eat as a way of traveling up and down in society, in the esteem of our friends, or into a different body. We try to cook ourselves better somehow, maybe into a bigger kitchen or a more accomplished persona, instead of meeting our hungers here and now, as we are. Sometimes these aspirations can push us outside of our comfort zone and lead us towards new experiences. But much of the time, we're so stuck in striving that we lose sight of the good stuff already right here in front of us, like the way onions cook in butter, or the fun of a corner shop snack haul, or the guidance of our own gut feelings. In case you haven't already realized, this cookbook doesn't have photos in it. I know how useful photos can be, especially if you're a visual learner or if you're not a confident reader. Photos can give us something to aim for, or a standard to hold our cooking attempts up against, to judge how well we've done. If you absolutely need photos, I'd encourage you to find a cookbook that will deliver on that front. There are many to choose from. But for most cooks, I don't believe things are that black and white. When we look through cookbooks at the photos, and believe me, I love doing this as much as you do, we're not just gleaning clues about what the food is and how to prepare it. We're also absorbing cues about lifestyle, class, and background, from everything from the silverware on the table to the usually white hands stirring the pot. This can be a beautiful thing, allowing author, photographer, stylist, and home economist to evoke a sense of place and time, setting the dishes in an appropriate cultural context, or simply showing the food in the best possible light. But it can also be limiting. By photographing a cookbook in one kitchen with one cook, I'd be capturing only one very narrow vision of what cooking looks like and who these recipes are for. Such photos can also end up feeling aspirational, drawing us towards the often unattainable, shiny, and new. With Cook As You Are, I knew the focus had to be different. I wanted a book that would show food being made in many different kitchens by many different people, some of whom may remind you of you as you already are. The focus of the imagery here is less on the food itself than on the places, hunger, and cultures from which that food is born. Food needs cooks and eaters. Without those human elements, it's just stuff. My hope is that you'll start to judge your success by whether the food tastes, smells, and looks good to you, not by whether it matches up with a photo of a meal staged by a meal stylist for a cookbook photo shoot. Think hard about what you consider to be good cooking. Sometimes this is just whatever fills you up. You can put those dreams of perfectly hosted dinners for friends to one side and settle comfortably in the realm of the everyday. Turning your kitchen into a tin pot dictatorship doesn't help anyone. The more upset you get at yourself for your real or imagined mistakes, more likely it is that your cooking will be shaped by that fear, and you'll end up with burnt onions and split custards. If you're reading this book, I'm guessing that there are at least moments in your life when cooking feels more than just functional, when you want to enjoy yourself as you cook and eat. And there's so much to be enjoyed. There's noticing an appetite for chips or hot chocolate or soothing pea soup at the exact moment it awakens, and knowing that you have the resources and the ability to satisfy that craving. There's the pride you have when you can feed yourself or someone you love. There's the freedom to cook by numbers or to go off-piste, to respect or disrespect the recipe in front of you. And, most importantly of all, at the center of all this, there's you, in your ordinary kitchen, with your likes and dislikes, your tastes and aversions, and your washing up piled in the sink, cooking as you are.
Jennifer has a reading for us.
Morning. Today I'm going to read something by Glennon Doyle. I'm not sure if you're familiar with her. She's sort of started out as a Christian mommy blogger, and then just as her memoir was coming out about how she was going to stand by her husband after all of his infidelities, she fell in love with a woman and is now married to Abby Wambach, who is a U.S. soccer star. So you can imagine her evangelical fan base did not react very well to her coming out and to her change in life. And so she had to tolerate a lot of internet hate, as you would imagine. And she's sort of emerged, and she wrote her most recent memoir. It's called Untamed. And it's really about living unapologetically, fully, without fear. And she also has a podcast that she does with her wife and her sister, who which is really good. I'm conflicted about Glennon because, like, part of it's very cringeworthy, but part of it's very profound and lots of insight. So when she's good, she's really, really good. So this is one of her pieces that I love. It's from Untamed, and it's called Sand Castles. Ask a woman who she is, and she'll tell you who she loves, who she serves, and what she does. I'm a mother, a wife, a sister, a friend, a career woman. The fact that we define ourselves by our roles is what keeps the world spinning. It's also what makes us untethered and afraid. If a woman defines herself as a wife, what happens when the partner leaves? If she defines herself as a mother, what happens when the kids go to college? If a woman defines herself as a career woman, what happens when the company folds? Who we are is perpetually being taken from us, so we live in fear instead of peace. We cling too tightly, close our eyes to what we need to look at hard, avoid questions that need to be asked, and in a million ways insist to our friends, our partners, and our children that the purpose of their existence is to define us. We build sandcastles and then try to live inside them, fearing the inevitable tide. Answering the question, who do I love, is not enough. We must live lives of our own. To live a life of her own, each woman must also answer, what do I love? What makes me come alive? What is beauty to me? And when do I take the time to fill up with it? Who is the soul beneath all of these roles? Each woman must answer these questions now, before the tide comes, because the tide rises. That's what the tide does. We must remember, I am the builder, not the castle. I'm separate and whole. Over here, eyes on the horizon, sun on my shoulders, welcoming the tide. Building, rebuilding, playfully, lightly, never changing, always changing.
Our final reader is Monica.
Good morning. I brought this tome with me. I was looking for something to read. I was thought maybe something meaningful and deep. And I picked up this book, which I dip into now and again. It's a poem for every day of the year. And it's edited by Ali Ezri. And the poem for last Friday was Full Moon by Vita Sackville-West. The editors describe it as a poem which has gaiety and mystery. But I think it's whimsical and colourful as well. And it lifted my spirits. She was wearing coral taffeta trousers. Someone had brought her from Isfahan. And the little gold coat with pomegranate blossoms and the coral-hafted feather fan. And she ran down a Kentish lane in the moonlight and skipped in the pool of moon as she ran. She cared not a rap for all the big planets, for Betelgeuse or Aldebaran. And all the big planets cared nothing for her, that small, impertinent charlatan. But she climbed on a Kentish stile in the moonlight and laughed at the sky through the sticks of her fan.
Thank you to all our readers. I think there was one or two we didn't get to, and they will be heading the list the next time we do this. We now have our third hymn, and it's hymn number 92, Mysterious Presence, Source of All. And while we sing it, we will have the offertory. Our notices. Thank you to everyone for sharing the readings this morning. And just to say, Bill chose the hymns this morning. If anyone either present in church or listening in would like to hear their favourite hymns, email me and we will use them. Everyone is invited to share fair trade tea and coffee downstairs in the Damer Hall. We'd love to see you down there. There are copies of Auskult magazine for the month of June on the table outside. Please take one. And also some copies of the Inquirer. The usual Wednesday service is on 1:05 to 1:35, available in the church and online. And the book club meet on the final Wednesday of the month. And this is Divina by Eugenie Fraser is this month's book. And the coming of age group will be meeting on the 11th of June after the service on the 11th of June. We have our final hymn now. It's hymn number 108, My Life Flows On in Endless Song. Hymn number 108. Beauty is before us and beauty is behind us. Above us and below us flowers the beautiful. We are surrounded by it and immersed in beauty. May we walk the beautiful trail of life in love, joy, and respect. Amen.